From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Hank Aaron, Josh Gibson, Ted Williams, and Wade Boggs were just a few of the best hitters in baseball history. Wayne Gretzky was the best at hockey, and Jordan was the finest basketball has produced. And you know what else is the best? The stories coming up on Only a Game, like the one about the scientists who compete by identifying as many living things as they can, or the librarians who jauntily wheel book carts around in carefully choreographed routines while clad in shiny costumes. Or how about the lobstermen and women who race their vessels as if the American lobster was the cheetah's aquatic counterpart? For all these and more, stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In the run-up to the 2008 Summer Games in Beijing, we heard many pronunciations of China's capital city. Imagine my confusion when, while tuning into HBO's Real Sports, none other than the esteemed Bryant Gumbel, knower of all things Olympics, made the following proclamation.
Spelled with a J, but pronounced with a Z. Beijing is rich in history, but still shrouded in mystery.
A mystery indeed. Where can I turn to solve this question?
Ni hao, I'm John.
Hi, I'm Carsey.
We're the two Chinese characters.
They're the two Chinese characters.
John Weinstein and Carsey Yi join me now on the line. John and Carsey, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, first of all, what is the correct pronunciation of the city hosting the 2008 Summer Games?
That correct pronunciation is Beijing. And I think it's quite simple to get it pretty close. And I feel like the jing, as in jingle bells, is something that all English speakers should be able to manage. And it's really much closer, anyway, to the perfect pronunciation.
Okay, so we'll call it close enough for American Bumpkin. Do you have any idea why so many people have gotten it wrong for such a long time?
Well, I have actually a theory on that, and it's based a little bit on history. Since I'm a historian of China, I think I can cover that. Since we've adopted the word Beijing, I think a lot of people think that because it's a Chinese word, it should be pronounced in a foreign-sounding way. So I think a lot of people simply adopt a French-sounding jeu sound rather than the very simple English jing.
And the irony is, while there are a few sounds that are hard for students, the jing is one of the easiest ones. So it's ironic that that's become so challenging.
On your own website, twochinesecharacters.com, you have posted a second video which teaches the official Chinese cheer of the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Wait, there's an official government-approved cheer?
There certainly is.
Would you guys like to just run through that once so people can hear you doing it?
Sure.
We certainly can. I think we should do it with NPR, Jiayou, which means Go NPR.
Okay.
NPR, Jiayou. NPR, Jiayou.
I can feel myself getting psyched up even as you do that. I think it's working.
Well, you know, the Chinese government does have great effectiveness with mass directives, and this is yet another step in that for us.
John Weinstein teaches the Chinese language at Simon's Rock. John, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill.
And Carsey Yi is a Chinese-Canadian working on a PhD in modern Chinese history at Harvard, though he's doing so from Toronto. Carsey, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
When I was a kid, science geeks were picked last for the playground kickball game. They didn't become popular for their ability to pronounce the Latin names of common plants, and girls didn't go crazy for boys who collected bugs in jars. But in the summer of 2008, Only a Game's Karen Given attended an event in Westerly, Rhode Island, where those stereotypes no longer apply.
It's 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and the opening horn of the 9th annual Rhode Island BioBlitz is only an hour away. While participants check in and get a map of the site, the 500-acre Grills Preserve in southern Rhode Island, organizer David Gregg uses a blue marker to scribble numbers into a chart on a large easel.
I'm posting the records, the BioBlitz records.
A BioBlitz is a 24-hour event where hundreds of scientists, both professional and amateur, run around and document every living thing they can find. Greg is with the Rhode Island Natural History Survey. He starts with a count of all the species that can theoretically be found in the state of Rhode Island. In some categories, a successful BioBlitz will only identify 80 or 90 of more than 1,000 possibilities. But the scientists are at a bit of a disadvantage. Some of the species in question haven't actually been seen in the state in decades.
This is the first BioBlitz where we have a decent chance of seeing a black bear. There is a black bear that came into Rhode Island several weeks ago. It was spotted in a whole sequence of towns coming down from the north, and then it was sighted last week in Westerly, just down the river from here. So we're very excited to have a black bear this year. We'll see how that goes.
The Natural History Survey picks a different site every year, alternating between coastal and inland parks and nature preserves. It's not only fun practice for scientists, but Harvey Perry, president of the Westerly Land Trust, says the BioBlitz helps to preserve the land by creating an inventory of what's there and what needs to be protected.
There are ponds and granite outcroppings and lagoons and streams, and there's swamp and marsh and pine barrens, and it's all kinds of stuff. So if we were to hire people to do an inventory here, it would cost a fortune. And for us, it's virtually free. And we'll now know what we have.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Go!
All right.
I got one.
Okay, good.
All right.
As David Gregg sounds the opening horn, someone holds up a specimen he found crawling on his workbench and can identify on sight. While no species is too small or too common to be counted, Gregg says everyone here wants to be the one who finds the rare plant or animal.
We're really all naturalists because we want to be famous. Oh, is that the David Gregg who discovered the Cicindela dorsalis population? Yes, I think it is. You know, or is that the Harvey Perry who found that population of, you know, Polygonum cuspidoides? Yes, I think it might be. So, you know, that's what gets the people here.
The big warbler.
Norm Dudziak and Tom Kutcher hike into the woods to set traps for freshwater invertebrates. Neither is an expert in the field, but the team leader can't arrive until later, and Norm and Tom need to get a head start on collecting samples if they're going to have any hope of a good showing. Less than 10 minutes after entering the preserve, Dudziak and Kutcher spot their first sight, a slow-moving stream just 50 yards or so off the main trail. While Norm sets his trap, Tom uses a net to see what he can find. Tom dips the net into the water and skims along the bottom of the stream. He painstakingly picks through the mud and muck and drops at least a dozen unique samples into his first collection bag.
The invertebrates are the gold mine for species.
Because there's so many different ones.
So many of them, yeah.
I mean, those are tiny, tiny.
Yeah, I have no idea what they are.
I don't even know if I would recognize that as something other than a piece of dirt.
Yeah, it's got more legs.
The Grills Preserve is normally a serene place, but during the BioBlitz, the site is practically overflowing with scientists. The mammal team is setting traps. An algae specialist from the University of Rhode Island is collecting water samples. Two guys named Jeff and Noel are scouring the woods for fungi. And Keith, a graduate student from Syracuse, New York, is collecting all the moss he can find. Tom and Norm follow crashing noises that sound like they could be coming from a moose into a sphagnum bog, only to be disappointed to discover that the mammal in question won't even be added to the final BioBlitz count.
It looks like people. That's people over there.
Oh, darn. The mysterious people.
10 minutes! 10 minutes!
Less than 24 hours later, Friday afternoon's calm vibe has been replaced by a bit more urgency. The spider expert's microscope isn't working. The fungi team still has a dozen unidentified samples. And David Gregg realizes that no one has remembered to count the butterflies.
Butterflies have always been tough. The butterfly people have always had an uphill climb. But 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh my gosh, we are skunked.
Most of the bioblitzers slept in tents on the site, if they slept at all. They've hiked over hills, canoed up streams, and lugged traps and collection bags all over the 500-acre preserve. Lou Perotti, the conservation programs coordinator for the Roger Williams Park Zoo in Providence, hasn't given much thought as to whether bioblitz is a sport, but he smiles at the proposition.
Oh, it's certainly athletic, and yeah, there's a bit of friendly competitiveness. Who can find the rarest thing? Who can find the most? You know, you have, you know, very high-level biologists and taxonomists working right alongside citizen scientists, which is fantastic. Everybody walks away learning something or at least having a better appreciation for the biota of Rhode Island.
Microscopes down! Okay, that's BioBlitz 2008. And we will now add up the results, and in a few minutes we will announce the winners.
Greg builds suspense by announcing this year's count category by category. It was, in fact, a bad year for butterflies, but the fish team broke the previous record by 7. The botany team found some extremely rare plants, including one that had never been observed in the state and another that hadn't been seen here since 1921. But like every good sporting event, there has to be a winner, and Greg seems confident in his choice.
Now, the mosses. The BioBlitz record is 16. And that, you know, was probably me and Rick Enser going, I don't know, those two look different. Let's count these. And the standing stones gathered 70 species of mosses. 7-0. So the moss team totally wins the prize for the best team effort this year. Most improved and the overall best team effort.
But what does the Moss team get for their efforts? Certainly there's a trophy, or a plaque, or at least a ribbon.
Bragging rights.
So there is no prize.
Bragging rights. Maybe next year we'll come up with some, you know, certificate suitable for framing.
The 2008 Rhode Island BioBlitz documented 1,111 species, besting the previous record by 100. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon in Westerly, Rhode Island. She said,
you can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear our program and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860, and you can visit our website, onlyagame.org. Like I want to be loved by you. It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, Renegade Librarians on Wheels, but first. It was a mild, sunny weekday afternoon on the campus of Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Massachusetts. Such a beautiful day that as I looked out over the green, dandelion-dotted infield and the composition track that circles it, it was hard to imagine that on Saturday, May 17th, 2008, this place would be going nuts. That's when the Eastern Athletic Association for the Blind, an organization of schools from Massachusetts to Florida, would stage its 62nd track and field tournament, an event originally designed to demonstrate that students who are blind can be athletes too. Athletes, and as became obvious on Saturday morning when the events got underway, fans as well.
On your marks!
One of the competitors in the 50-yard dash was a slight 20-year-old woman named Erin, who was representing the West Virginia School for the Blind in Romney, West Virginia. Erin and the two other competitors in her heat would race while holding on to devices that slid along cables running the length of the sprint course. Erin's coach is Donna C.
Erin, you got to go when he blows the whistle. Listen. Go, Erin, go!
For blind sprinters, finishing the race is only part of the challenge. After they cross the finish line, they have to turn around and follow the cable back to the start. Maybe it's excess adrenaline, but most of them run back to the starting line.
You're almost here. You're almost here. You're almost here. Stop. Stop.
Nice job, Aaron.
There. Good job. You won that heat?
Yes, I did.
Yes, you did. Come on. Here's your cane. You cold? You want to put your jacket back on?
Yes, I'm cold.
Though Erin is a veteran of track meets like the one at Perkins that weekend in May, I learned after her race that there are some aspects of the competition to which she can't seem to get accustomed.
Well, I didn't like the gun, but I liked the whistle.
And they accommodated you. They blew the whistle instead of shooting the gun.
Yeah.
Most of Erin's responses to my questions about her triumph on the track were short and to the point, but when I asked her about the dance, scheduled to follow the awards ceremony on Saturday evening, she suddenly became more loquacious.
I wanted to dance with Carl, but Carl's the bus driver, so I might dance with him this evening. I like Carl.
He'll be a lucky guy if you do.
Yeah, I want to dance with him tonight.
The attraction of the dance notwithstanding, it's the competition that has provided the incentive for Erin and her teammates to spend 12 hours on the school bus in which the aforementioned Carl carried them to Watertown. Donna C. told me that each of the athletes from West Virginia had earned his or her place through competition back home.
We do have 2 months of practice prior to this, and we let them try all the events, and we try to pick out the ones that we feel they're the best at and have the best chance of winning a medal. Because they do give medals for the first six. Oh, gosh, forgot to warn you again.
Shit.
They do get medals for the first six places. So we try to put them in an event that we think that they would possibly get a medal in.
The competitors are divided into categories, depending in part on the degree to which they can see. Runners with partial vision often compete on their own. Distance runners who cannot see are tethered to a sighted runner who had better be able to keep up. Triumphant in the former category was a lanky 18-year-old named B.J. Peterson, who won his heat in the 440 going away. BJ was representing the Maryland School for the Blind, and while the three young men running against him were reduced to jogging and gasping for breath with 100 yards to go, Peterson cruised by them and then to the wire. There, he revealed his strategy.
I was thinking of basically doing the same thing with the mile, keep up with them, and on once I got right over to the where we started at, just to start running as fast as I could.
Yeah, it worked out that time, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Excellent.
For a minute, I thought I wasn't going to be able to beat that one kid from New York for a second.
BJ has been to three of these tournaments. According to Hannah Marley, who coaches the girls' team at the Overbrook School for the Blind in Philadelphia, athletes with that sort of experience, no matter whose colors they're wearing, are counted on to help their teammates.
We have a few girls who are here for the first time. They're really nervous, but they have the older girls who've been here for 4 or 5 years, and they really just look up to them. And I'm only my second year, so sometimes I look up to them for their help as well, because they sometimes know what's going on better than I do. But the younger girls just follow in the footsteps of the older girls, more or less, yeah.
Let's go, Rashida.
Don't jump.
Do your thing, girl. Don't look to the side.
Watch your ears, please.
Are you ready?
Let it hurt.
Yes, yeah,
The encouragement was palpable throughout the meet on Saturday, not only at the track, but at the pit, where students were competing in a variation of the triple jump, and in the infield, where they were throwing softballs and footballs and putting the shot. Nor were the competitors the only ones who were excited and happy on this day, though Earl Haley, the coach for the New York Institute track and field team in the Bronx, said he feels this way pretty much all the time. Coach Haley, born in Guyana, has been helping children with various disabilities learn to run and jump and throw for 17 years.
I love to see the kids run. I love to see them compete. And, you know, it gives me great joy just to see them having fun and, you know, and they compete against each other. And I enjoy watching them doing it. And I enjoy working with them. I look forward, you know. I look forward to go to work. I mean, I know a lot of people don't say this, but I look forward to go to work.
If I were to go back to the Perkins campus today, I would find that the bang of the starting gun, replaced sometimes at a runner's request by the whistle, and the encouraging shouts of coaches and the roar of the excitable crowd, had given way to the customary quiet of the green campus. But I'd also find that the competition and its aftermath have not been forgotten by those students fortunate enough to have participated in the 62nd annual EAAB track and field tournament, a group for whom 19-year-old John Mazzetti, a Perkins student, spoke eloquently about the significance of the track meet.
I think it's really cool. I think because you get a feel of how different schools are run and the different people at different schools. And, you know, as Perkins, we're already very diverse, but to see, you know, multiple cultures intertwine or multiple groups intertwine to make one big group, it's pretty awesome.
Synchronized swimming, gymnastics, ice skating, and ice dancing all feature choreography. But as Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder reported at the American Library Association's 2008 National Conference in Anaheim, there's a fifth sport requiring orchestrated moves, and you'll never guess what it is.
At 3:45 on a recent Sunday afternoon, my stereotype of librarians was completely turned on its head.
Sexy? Hold on, I gotta talk to her. I'm sorry, did you just say librarians are sexy?
Oh, we are, we are. Just ask our husband and those teenagers that come to my library.
We give it away for free.
I've heard, but for 2 weeks or 3 weeks at a time, I've heard.
And you can renew whenever you'd like.
That's Tammy. I'm not going to give you her last name because, well, she's a California school librarian, and I don't want her to get fired. She's one of the California girls, a team of 8 school librarians, competing in this year's American Library Association Book Cart Drill Team Championships. That's right, Book Cart Drill Team. While Tammy and I exchange bad puns, the rest of her team apply temporary tattoos to their midriffs. You know, stuff like librarians rule and read or die. Which surprises me, but probably not the ALA's Director of Conference Services, Deirdre Ross, who organized today's competition.
It does tell people librarians are very different, not what you thought. They're lots of fun and very creative.
Ross first heard about book cart drill teams in, well, a book.
And I looked at the book and I thought, well, this is a thing, you know, and I hadn't realized that it was just a librarian thing, and most of the teams did it in parades, like the 4th of July parade or the Memorial Day parade.
The photos of librarians dancing with decorated book carts excited Ross so much, she thought a drill team competition would be a great addition to the ALA's national conference. So, 3 years ago, she tried it out.
And it was just mesmerizing because people just put their heart and soul in it, and it was just like more than I ever had expected.
At this year's conference in Anaheim, 8 teams from Delaware to California, including Bibliotechies, Palm Desert Cart Attacks, and Bibliophiles, are putting their heart and soul into it. One team I speak with from Riverside County Library West in California tells me they don't just want to push book carts back and forth between team members and do a pirouette every now and then. They want to tell a story through song about James Bond.
You'll hear parts where he's talking about his relationships with women. They end bad, so he's going to have a woman, you know, he's going to get slapped. His woman that he loves is going to get killed, and so we go by the lyrics.
That's Gilmore, Aaron Gilmore, the newest Bond, a youthful, bespectacled lad who's more Harry Potter than Roger Moore. He and his team, call number 007, get it? call number 007. Rehearse twice a week for 2 months for today's competition. On the other side of the curtain that separates the Anaheim Convention Center's backstage area from the audience, about 2,000 spectators gather to see just how creative librarians can get with book carts. One, Morgan Murray, tells me he hopes to see one of his fantasies become a reality.
Well, you know, there's always that image of the librarian who's got her glasses and her hair up in a bun, and then she takes the hair clip out and tosses her hair and throws the glasses off, and this pretty much is consistent with that sort of passing the image.
There's always that image?
As the competition begins, most of the routines bring to mind vintage MGM musicals and are exactly what Morgan Murray hopes to see. At one point, I think, oh my word, it's librarians gone wild. In one routine, a woman stands atop two book carts. Then her teammates slowly pull them apart until she's suspended midair in a split. The California girls enhance their number by reaching under their shirts, pulling their bikini tops off, and throwing them high into the air. But it's team call number 007 that takes the competition to a new level, according to today's Master of Ceremonies, children's author, Mo Willems.
It's beautiful how much, you know, we had the sex, but you added the violence. My library, very little sex and violence.
There's the simulated violence, of course, but there's also accidental violence, when mid-routine, a faux slap to James Bond's face gets a little too close for comfort.
He just lost his glasses.
A mishap that costs the team major points with the judges.
9.007 for a grand total of 007 points.
Thanks,
congratulations.
In the end, though, nothing pleases a crowd, even a crowd of bookworms, like early 80s Michael Jackson. Something Santa Monica Library's well-stacked cibrarians understand. Despite the team's name, the cibrarians' routine is more rated G than R. Their book carts sport biohazard signs and beakers that overflow with smoke. They're dressed like Albert Einstein, lab coat, wig, and all. But when Thriller starts playing and the cibrarians morph into dancing zombies, the crowd, normally known for shushing people, gets loud. Really loud. It may not be the stuff of New York Times bestsellers, but the Jackson homage wins the crowd over, and the judges.
9.95! Oh,
sweet.
Or as my mother would say, 0.05 from doing a good job.
When the totals are added up, the well-stacked cibrarians are victorious. Afterwards, I speak with the team's choreographer, Shauna Johnson, a former cheerleader turned youth services librarian.
What does it mean to win this competition?
Oh, it's amazing. This is the first thing that we've ever done. We just got together about 2 months ago. We practiced, and it's amazing that we came out where we did.
Are you going to cry? Don't cry on me. Don't cry.
I'm not.
She doesn't. Well, she does. A little. Then, a few minutes later, an elated Morgan Murray, the spectator with a librarian fantasy, pulls me aside. He was right, I tell him. Librarians really do let their hair down, to which he counters.
Every librarian wants to show off their sensuous side.
Although the well-stacked cibrarians prove that, at least when it comes to book carts, sex doesn't always sell. For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Anaheim, California.
But when I try in here to tell you, dear, I love you madly, madly, Madam Librarian, Marian, it's a long lost cause I can never win.
You're listening to Only a Game. Estimates of the ultimate worth of the 8 gold medals Michael Phelps won in Beijing initially ranged from $30 to $100 million. After the 2008 Summer Games had concluded, Only a Game wondered if perhaps Phelps, like another Olympian who found fame in the water, Esther Williams, should try his luck in the movies.
But Mickey, the arrangements, the flowers, the hundreds of guests, and oh, that beautiful cake.
I'm sorry, I really am, but I gotta swim.
Oh, Daddy, he's gone.
Yes, dear, he is.
And quickly. Jeez, can that kid swim?
Yes, that kid can swim. Michael Phelps stars in Broken Dreams. Not mine, yours.
Do you think he'll ever come back?
I should think so. It's only 50 meters to the end of the pool. Then he'll come back.
And then?
Then he'll turn around and do another lap, I guess. It's what he does.
Oh, Daddy.
We may not be giving Mr. Phelps enough credit here. Were he in a crime drama, he could probably learn to do something more than swim.
Damn it! The masked bandit's gone into the pool! Get me Lieutenant Phelps!
What's up, Captain?
How the heck did you...
I swam.
No time for chat. The masked bandit dove into the pool. Nobody but you can catch him before he gets to the other end, scrambles out, runs away in his cumbersome, soaking wet three-piece suit and wingtips, and disappears into the criminal underworld.
No problem.
Why are you still here, Phelps? Can't you see the masked bandit is escaping?
I'm just trying to make a contest of it, sir.
Damn it, Phelps, this isn't...
Got him, Captain.
Or maybe an action movie. Yeah, that might be it. An action movie.
A long time ago, in a swimming pool far, far away, there were some bad guys in the water.
Separatists in the pool there are.
Where? I can't see them. My goggles are filled with water.
Within yourself, look.
What?
Or in the pool, look.
I'll try.
Swim or swim not. There is no try. But beware. Once down the dark lane you start, forever it will dominate your destiny. Drown you it will.
Oddly, Michael Phelps still hasn't taken advantage of any of those cinematic ideas. Still, we look forward to whatever else he may decide to do in the wake, get it, in the wake there, of one of the most exceptional performances ever turned in by an athlete at the Olympic Games or anywhere else. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When the bells all ring and the horns all blow, and the couples we know are fondly kissing, will I be with you, or will I be among the missing? Maybe it's much too early in the game. Oh, but I thought I'd ask you just the same. What are you doing, New Year's? New Year's Eve.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. Spirits are buoyed at Maine's lobster boat races. But first, like to see some stuck-up jockey boy sitting on Dan Patch? Make your blood boil, I should say. So spoke Harold Hill, the flim-flamming music man of the musical comedy of the same name. A jockey boy, stuck-up or not, would have been superfluous on Dan Patch. The horse pulled a sulky. He was a pacer, and not just a pacer, but the beloved and famous pacer that set records and won hearts at every stop on the Grand Circuit during the days when the country was much younger and the pacers and trotters, rather than the thoroughbreds, were kings. In Crazy Good, subtitled The True Story of Dan Patch, the Most Famous Horse in America, Charles Learson tells the story of that horse. I asked him if, when he started thinking about telling that story, the people with whom he spoke even knew there had been a horse called Dan Patch.
Oh, how true. I say, I'm writing a book, and they'd say, what's it about? And I'd say, Dan Patch. And then they would feel very bad because they'd never heard of the horse. And I'd touched this point with often very intelligent people and I'd found something they didn't know about, and they felt bad for a few seconds, and then they sort of felt like displeased with me and angry with me. And they made some wild guesses as to who he was. Some people thought he was an old ball player. The name has a kind of a maybe turn of the 20th century sound to it. And then one person said to me, isn't that a name for the devil? And I think he had him confused with Old Scratch. I had to look that up.
Though Dan Patch is the star of your story, Crazy Good is full of intriguing two-legged characters as well. Myron McHenry, perhaps foremost among them. Of Mr. McHenry, the man who drove Dan Patch, you write, apart from the money to be made, he found the idea of hoodwinking the public irresistible. Tell me more of Myron McHenry.
This was a mean, cranky man, beyond cranky. He was a superstar of his day, and he's kind of a parallel figure to Dan Patch. Everyone knew who Myron McHenry was. He was the best sulky driver, harness racing driver, of his day. And like Dan Patch, he's been completely forgotten. He was a hard liver, a drinker and a womanizer and, had probably other faults, too. And he did. He set up a few fixed races, as we describe in the book. But he was known as the Wizard of the Home Stretch. Everyone had a nickname, or some people had like seven nicknames in those days. And he was a figure of great fascination, but he had almost no horses in his stable at any one time because he was so mean, and because he also like hit on the wives of the owners of the horses, and he would eventually lose these horses. So his career is a story of great horses slipping through his fingers, and that's what happened actually with Dan Patch also.
You write that the grand circuit upon which Dan Patch performed was intriguingly impure, as all horse racing has always been. But is it fair to say that Dan Patch brought a kind of purity to the game?
Well, he did, Bill. He raced against other horses, of course, in the beginning of his career, and then he ran out of competition. And then he went on to race against the clock. Racing was so crooked in those days that people appreciated it. It was like a no-nonsense, hey, it's either he beats the clock or he doesn't. and no fooling around. And you could bet on that. But in those days, they had heat racing, like best three out of four or two out of three. And that allowed so many opportunities. You could still win the race, but you could lose an individual heat. So these guys really fooled around. And because if you lost a heat with a horse like Dan Patch, and this actually happened twice with Dan Patch, he was stiffed, you could then introduce a little bit of doubt as to whether the horse was really up to it and get higher odds in the subsequent heat while cashing a bet on another horse in the heat in which you hold Dan Patch back in, if you follow that. So there was a lot of fooling around in those days, and people both took it as part of the game but didn't like it at the same time.
Perhaps even more remarkable than his speed and his record on the track against other horses was Dan Patch's disposition. He was gentle, especially with children, and when the crowd cheered, he bowed in recognition. Or did you make that up?
I didn't. I mean, not only didn't I make it up, but his trainer never taught him to do that. The old cantankerous, cranky Myron McHenry, that's the last thing he would do is bring a horse back and have him bow nicely before the crowd. He'd bring him back and spit at the crowd, maybe. But Dan Patch wanted to do this. Whenever he saw a photographer, a guy aiming a camera at him, he stopped. He got the idea of the superstar thing, and he liked it. You know, he had this quality that it comes down to, I think, is trust. He trusted humans, and human beings appreciated him for that and loved him. He didn't worry unnecessarily like a lot of horses do, and it's understandable. They don't know what's going to happen next. But Dan Patch just took everything in stride. And as you mentioned, he was very gentle. Children used to run back and forth beneath his stomach. When he got back home in Minnesota in the off season, he would pull kids on his sleigh around town. Kind of a remarkable thing. You won't see Big Brown doing that in the bluegrass country.
Dan Patch inspired at least two musical compositions and also what you have called the worst poem ever written. I wonder if you would be so kind as to recite that poem.
Well, this is from the Horse Review, which was a magazine that came out weekly in those days. I'll see if I can do it justice. This was after one of his big wins, after he set the world record once again. We hail thee, proud monarch of the turf, and yield to thee thy laurels fairly won. Dauntless is thy courage, matchless is thy worth. By thee all kings before thee are undone. It's pretty horrible.
Hey, if it's not the worst, it's among them, as they say.
But yeah, there are either other poems about him in the Horse Review that kind of mixed black dialect with Irish dialect. It was just awful. So people couldn't control themselves when it came to Dan Patch.
Dan Patch died on July 11th, 1916. How did the world of harness racing and the world beyond harness racing respond?
Well, it's funny. He'd been so popular. He made $1 million a year endorsing products. This is at a time when Ty Cobb, the highest paid baseball player, was making $12,000 a year. But by the time he died, and he lived to be 20, which is not an extraordinarily old age for a horse, but the world had changed. The automobile had arrived, and the horse that was so beloved, even as he was a practical everyday thing, became old-fashioned. And people turned away from horses. And when Dan Patch finally died, his death didn't make big headlines, I found. And it's kind of poignant and sad. And he was on his way to being forgotten even while he was alive, because he represented a kind of technology which had been superseded by the automobile.
Charles Learson is the author of Crazy Good, The True Story of Dan Patch, the Most Famous Horse in America, published by Simon & Schuster. He joined me from the NPR studios in New York. Charles, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
And listen to some big out-of-town Jasper hearing him talk about horse race gambling. Not a wholesome trotting race, no, but a race where they sit down right on a horse. I'd like to see some stuck-up jockey boy sitting on Dan Patch, make your blood boil, well, I should say. Now, friends, let me tell you what I mean. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pockets in the table. Pockets that mark the difference between a gentleman and a...
Lobster boats are a common sight off the shores of Maine. They're built for hard work on the rugged Atlantic coast, not for speed. But, as with most things powered by internal combustion engines, there is a time and place for races. In August of 2008, Only a Game's Doug Trabue headed to Maine to hit the lobster boat racing circuit, and he has our report.
It's a bright, clear Saturday morning in Winter Harbor, a very small port in Maine, more than 3 hours north of Portland by land. At the far end of a straight track, several lobster boats, with partially open cockpits and low-slung sterns, line up with the starting boat. There's a man with a large, bright orange flag standing on the bow. When the boats pull into line, the flag drops, and the captains hit the throttle.
Word on to a friend. There he goes.
74 boats have registered to race today in the 8th of the Maine Lobster Boat Racing Association's annual 9-race schedule. I'm aboard the finish line boat, Easy Rider, near a tall buoy holding a red and white flag. Several people in race official T-shirts are preparing to record the order of each finish. There are some veterans on the crew, but it's the first time for a number of the officials, and some aren't even from Maine. At least two New Hampshire residents were recruited to join the crew during some pre-race festivities out on the town last night. Races last roughly 60 to 90 seconds. Winter Harbor's track is one of the longest and widest, so boats have the best chance of reaching their top speeds. Most boat names are painted on the transom or rear panel, so their large wakes make it hard to identify them as they pass by.
That's who's that? Okay, that's 4. What's the other one? Green.
Maine Lobster Boat Racing Association President John Johansson says the first races were held in the early 1900s off the coast of Jonesport.
As far as history, there's no real accurate records of when they started. You know, going back and starting in the 60s and coming up is basically when we started racing like we do today.
The association now has 19 classes that separate gas engines from diesel and factor in horsepower and boat length. Some boats only enter in their home port. Others travel to all the races. Each division winner gets a plaque at the end of the season, but the local ports also offer prizes. Bushels of bait, new lobster traps, cash, and all of today's racers are entered in a drawing for 1,000 gallons of fuel. Winter Harbor's prizes were valued at more than $11,000 this year. Other harbors topped $20,000. But Winter Harbor Race Committee co-chair Chris Church says something much more important is at stake.
Bragging rights, that's the biggest part of it. You know, everybody comes down, it's a real good time.
For some racers, winning bragging rights is serious business. A number of boat owners tell me about pulling an all-nighter to replace parts, tighten heads, and even trade out engines. Other owners are just here to enjoy the camaraderie. There are plenty of entrants that finish at least 30 seconds off the pace, but everyone on board is smiling all the way. The rules require just a captain and one other person to be aboard, but some boats are weighed down with at least a dozen partygoers, all in life vests, just along for the ride and the good time. One racer takes a distant second-place finish in a two-boat race in stride.
Thank you.
I almost hit it. It was close. It was close.
There are fans along the shore and on pleasure boats around the track. Rich and Sonia Sobolewski and their children came from Marlton, New Jersey, and are on board the finish line boat. Rich likes the low-key approach to the event.
There's a feel to it that's personal. It's not commercialized racing. It reminds me of drag races at home on high school nights.
And how does a family from New Jersey end up with the best seats in the harbor?
Friend of a friend.
Got connections?
Yes.
On Sunday in Pemaquid, a village in the town of Bristol, Maine, the world's fastest lobster boat, Foolish Pleasure, is on hand for a $1,000 speed challenge during the last races of the season. But there's a bit of controversy. Owner Galen Alley of Beals Island was planning to break the local mark of 59.7 miles an hour.
So all season long, everywhere I went, I wanted to break their hometown speed records. Well, I didn't know that when I got up here that I was going to have to break my own speed record, not Pemaquid's speed record, but my own. And we went 64.1 in friendship. So it looks like we better go 64.2 if we plan on winning any money.
Unlike most of the boats, Foolish Pleasure is not a working lobster boat. Working boats often weigh several tons. Foolish Pleasure checks in at 2,300 pounds, including the engine. Allie's first run falls short at 61.1 miles an hour. Later, he wins his race, but the closest Foolish Pleasure comes to the record is 63.4. High fuel prices have hurt the industry and driven up the cost of other necessities like bait. Meanwhile, the retail price of lobster is down, and fishermen say lobster's image as a luxury item hurts sales when the economy is tight. Travis Otis is the vice president of Maine Lobster Boat Racing. He and his father, Keith, organized the races at Searsport, and they've invited me aboard First Team, a 36-foot working boat they built themselves. They're undefeated in the races they've entered this year and won the points title in Diesel Class H. Travis says at a tough time for the industry, the races are the perfect release.
When you spend 5 or 6 days a week with your head stuck in a trap, it's nice to get together with other people. We're in the same boat, really, and have a good time.
There are a number of long delays as we watch the early heats, something Keith Otis has come to expect.
Sometimes one never knows what they're waiting for. It's like watching paint peel. We're sitting here waiting for them to stage the next race, and I don't know what's happened to it.
Eventually, First Team is called to the starting line in a field of six with KE2, Taylor C., Porky's Revenge, Laura P., and Breezy Dawn. Travis Otis is at the helm and has warned me the turbo will take a few seconds to kick in. To our right, KE2 quickly pulls ahead of us by more than a boat length. Then, within seconds, Travis blasts us past the rest of the field. We cross the line with a comfortable lead at 35.7 miles an hour.
Well, that was pretty fun.
It's a long wait for a few seconds. If you see that piece of paint peel and then drop, you're there for it. But if you happen to be doing something else when it drops, then you don't know when it happened. That's lobster boat racing right there in a peanut shell. I mean, you sit around and wait and go through all the other races. You get that few seconds and you get that little bit of bragging rights. And, you know, KE2 put on a good show.
After the race, the boats are tied together in long chains extending from the dock. People cross from boat to boat, eating, drinking, and discussing the day's biggest prize, bragging rights. Winners and losers alike all seem happy to be here. Association President John Johansson says on very rare occasions, a non-fan will ask him, why bother racing?
I tell them that the reason that we go fast is because the lobsters are going faster, so we have to build bigger boats with bigger engines.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Trabu in Bristol, Maine.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our lobster boat racing photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Winter Harbor Lobster Race organizer Keith Young, who explains the $5 hike in this year's race registration fee.
Well, this year it's $25 because they got a free T-shirt.
Wow, that must be a pretty nice T-shirt. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.